I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome back to Radio Times. A couple of times a year, we take the show on the road to get out of our studio, to meet our listeners, and to tape an interview before a live audience of WHYY supporters and donors. This Tuesday night, we went to Bryn Mawr College to talk with local novelists, Lisa Scottolini and Jennifer Weiner. I've interviewed them many times over the past 25 years, but never together. They actually have some things in common. They didn't start their careers as novelists. Lisa was a lawyer and Jennifer was a journalist. They are both wildly successful, selling millions of books between them. Jennifer's latest book is Who Do You Love? Lisa's is titled Corrupted. And readers feel like they know them because they share so much about their personal lives, their families, their appearance. Lisa's menagerie of animals, Jennifer's battle with the New York Times over their choice of book reviews, and her feud with novelist Jonathan Franzen. Let's listen to our conversation. And I put my first question to Lisa Scottolini. So here we are at Bryn Mawr College, and I'm trying to imagine you two in college. Lisa, what did you think your career was going to be when you were a sophomore in college?
I was an English major, and that meant that in my day, if you were good in English, you went to law school, and if you were good in math, you went to med school. But I secretly wanted to be a novelist, so here I am fulfilling my secret.
And how about for you, Jennifer?
Rabble-rouser.
Troublemaker?
Troublemaker. And writer. I always knew this was what I wanted to do. It was always the only thing I was good at. And I graduated in a recession in 1991, and I remember going to my parents, who had been spectacularly, horrifically divorced by then, and saying, would either one of you be interested in being a patron of the arts?
And
supporting me for a year while I write a novel about how badly your divorce has messed with me. And they each quickly turned me down. And so one of my professors, I was trying to think of a career where you got paid to write. I mean, law school was always an option. It was, because that was the thing you did if you could write and wanted, you know, presumably job security, right? So I was thinking it was either going to be advertising or journalism, and I didn't want to do advertising because I was convinced that I would end up on the Tampax campaign and that my whole life would be thinking up synonyms for absorbent. And then what happened, I will tell this really quickly, years and years later, like, I've written a couple books and they're doing pretty well, and my agent calls me up and she says, I got a call from a brand of feminine protection products and they asked if you wanted to be a campus ambassador. And I'm like, do I have to dress as a giant tampon? And my agent says no. And I said, could I dress as a giant tampon? And she says, I don't think so. And I said, well, call them back and ask. And while they're on the phone, find out if there's strings attached.
Oh my gosh.
And she's like, I'm getting off the phone now. I'm like, just give me a minute. It's a lot to absorb. So I know.
I'm really glad you became a novelist.
Yes, exactly. I became a journalist. I got a job at a small, crappy newspaper and just moved on up.
And Lisa, you went to Penn Law School?
Yes. You told them I was a lawyer right out. I wanted them to like me, but you led with the lawyer stuff. Now I'm screwed.
But you left, I mean, after spending 3 years in law school, how long did you practice law before you
thought? I practiced law at Deckert for, I'm bad at math, but like 5 years or so, which it's kind of like dog years if you're a lawyer in a big firm, until my daughter was born, and then my life changed, really.
And you thought, I don't want to be a lawyer, I want to be a novelist?
I loved being a lawyer for the reason I love writing about the law. I love sort of the issues of justice, but I was a single mother. Like, it went like this. My divorce was final when she was crowning. I'm just being real here. But I said, gee, you've got to change your life now, because I sort of fell in love with the kid and wanted to stay home. And then basically, I said, well, you're an English major at Penn. You took a course with Philip Roth. We are not worthy. I like to say I studied under Philip Roth, but my daughter told me not to say that. So basically, I thought, well, at that time, and frankly, there still aren't a lot of women, particularly in thrillers and mysteries, there's not many women writing legal thrillers. Like, we were sort of, this is a dated reference, but bear with me, there was like Perry Mason, there's Della Street, and we were Della Street. I mean, so I said, well, I should be able to do this, and after 5 years of rejection, I got published.
What I find so interesting about you, Jen, is the fact that you really battled the New York Times over the kinds of books that you write, mm-hmm. about women, mm-hmm. in many ways,
perhaps four women mm-hmm. with likable characters. Mm-hmm. Do you feel like you have won that battle?
I do a little bit, because the week that Purity came out, Jonathan Franzen's new book was not on the cover of the New York Times Book Review. Elena Ferrante was. And I really did feel like the ground had shifted. I felt like we're finally seeing literary women get the kind of attention that literary men get. We are finally seeing women who write commercial fiction getting scraps of acknowledgement here and there. It's been hard, and it's been frustrating, and it's been humiliating at times. In February, the day before Valentine's Day, I was at home in Connecticut visiting my mom, and I was like checking my Twitter, and my Twitter like blew up all of a sudden. And I'm like, oh God, what happened here? Like, why is everybody saying, I'm so sorry, Jen, and gee, that really sucks that this happened on Galentine's Day, which is a thing. And it turns out Jonathan Franzen had given an interview, and the interviewer had asked him, you know, like, what do you think of Jennifer Weiner and her efforts to sort of get more attention for women writers? And he went off, and he said, I think she's an unfortunate spokesperson for the cause of feminism, and I think she's really just in it for herself. And then the interviewer very smartly said, have you read any of her books? And he says, no. No, I mean, first he said they were terrible, and then she said, which ones have you read? And he was like, I haven't, you know, like clutching his pearls. And basically then went on to say, you know, well, none of my friends say they're any good. And I'm like, who the f*** is going to recommend a book to Jonathan Franzen? Like, I mean, first of all, does he have friends? And second of all, who among them would be like, here, read this, it was really good. Like, what are you going to recommend to that guy? Like, The Odyssey? You know, like, it's lasted. People like it, you know? So, yes. But to bring it back, yes, I think that there has been progress made.
Well, and I should say that Jennifer coined a word, Franzenfreude.
Franzenfreude, yes. It's like Schadenfreude, only with him. You know, where it's like the feeling you get when it's like the New York Times reviewed his book for the third time, and you can't get them to say like a sentence about anything you ever wrote, and they're ignoring literary women. I mean, I'm happy, you know, people are just like, oh, she thinks that they should cover her the way they cover him. Well, that's not true. I think they should cover Mary Gateskill the way they cover him, and Elena Ferrante, and Lauren Groff, and Angela Florney, and all of these amazing women literary writers who've been put in the ghetto, who've been seen as less than, who have never gotten the attention that the, you know, straight white boys get just by default.
But I think that's changing.
I think it's changing too.
And you were very public in your
scorn,
criticism.
Yeah. In my scorn and my rage. Yeah, yes. You know what? Like, if you've got a platform, use it. Like, that's, I really do believe that. Like, I'm lucky enough to have people who listen to me on social media, in real life. And I didn't want to like use that platform to be like, here's a cute picture of my kid, or here's a beautiful picture of my living room, or here's a recipe that I wanted to change the world. I wanted to leave things better than when I found them.
Yeah.
And I have daughters, so it means a lot to me. And you've got a daughter, right. And you know.
Right. I mean, and I think just to interject here, to give you so much credit, because I think, you know, it's certainly Jen's right. It's her point of view, and it's mine as well. But this is really that there's sexism in reviewing. It's well established. It's not just, oh, we're being cranky. There's an organization, VIDA, that has done these statistics. It's sort of part of the world. I mean, there's sexism in the world, yeah. As we know, and there's racism, and we got to all deal with it. But I wanted to give you props because I don't want them to think it's just your unique view.
No, there's a lot of women. And I think for every woman who talks about it, there's probably five or six more that are like, well, I would say something, but I really want to get that short story published in The New Yorker, or I'm really hoping The Times reviews me.
But, you know, to me, what's so cool, although to add to this, that's what I love about books, and we're in a room of book lovers. You know, we get to speak directly to people in our books.
Yep.
And what's so great about what's happening now, especially if you're someone who hasn't always gotten attention from the gray lady or whatever it's called, the powers that be, we just try to write the best book you can write.
Absolutely.
And in this day and age, your review, to me, it always matters. I know it does to you too. You know, in other words, there's no gatekeeper anymore. It's true of reviewing. It's true of publishing. It's true across the board at a macro level. There's so much more democracy in everything. You can Yelp a restaurant. You can Yelp a book. You can Yelp things you buy. I sat there. I was going to buy a coffee pot. It took me like seven. I was sitting there. I was bewildered by all these coffee pot reviews. I'm like, okay, when did this get so hard? But the point is, it's a good thing because the power comes back to the people. Yeah. And that's where it belongs, especially in the arts. To me, especially in the arts.
Yeah. So how much do you read reviews of your books, Lisa?
Oh, I memorize reviews of my books.
Do you?
I beg for review. I wish I were reviewed more. It's been a, but you know, the truth is, that doesn't mean I don't want to pretend. Look, I'm not cool. Like, you knew that right off because I didn't tuck my shirt in because I can't. Great. But I'm very lucky. It's 25 books later, 25 years later. I feel lucky to be taken seriously by readers. But when anyone reviews me, and honestly, I read it. If there's a consensus, I'm listening to that. I think that's okay.
Yeah. How about for you, Jen?
No, it's the same thing. I mean, the famous Martin Amis quote is, you can let a bad review ruin your breakfast, but not your lunch. I mean, I've been known to let it ruin, like, months of meals, you know? So, but, you know, I agree with Lisa. I mean, you try to take them as constructive criticism, and if everybody's having the same problem, then there's a problem. And you better fix it. My first book came out in 2001, and there was no social media. There was barely an internet, and it was mostly for porn. And now,
Not like now.
But now, it's like, you know, writers are expected to promote their own work and solicit their own publicity in ways we never were. I mean, talk about the ground shifting. The expectations that you're going to be interacting with your readers, you're going to be on Facebook, on Instagram, on Twitter, you know, all those places, making yourself available and sort of, you know, opening the doors. It's really, really interesting. And very few writers are elite enough to be able to say, yeah, thanks, but no thanks. I'm not going to be doing that.
Yeah. But the thing is, like anything when you get older, you develop a really thick skin for anything. And if you live alone like somebody we know, you know, with a couple of, like, too many dogs and too many cats. I kind of love that interaction. All my tweets are me. Mm-hmm. All the Facebook's me. Mm-hmm. You see the pictures of the dogs, whatever. It's really very cool to be able to talk to your people who read you. And so you connect in so many ways. My daughter said something once I thought was really true. Some writers write to go within, and some writers write to go without. And I think that's sort of me. Like, I love the... I'm going to hug everybody tonight. You know, it's, like, weird. And so the social media, while you're uh-huh. right, it does take time. Mm-hmm. Kind of like it, got to admit.
No, I love it. I love it.
Like it. But do you think... I mean, do you guys... Are you on Twitter? Would you... I don't follow somebody if I think the tweets are manufactured or just promotion.
Right. That's...
Like, you get it.
Real
like,
turn
okay,
off.
That's not... Yeah.
That was Jennifer Weiner and Lisa Scott-Leany, recorded earlier this week when we took Radio Times on the road to Bryn Mawr College. We talked about their lives as writers. Much more after this very short break. We'll be right back. I'm Marty Moscoen. You're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY. Let's get back to our interview with best-selling novelists Lisa Scott-Leany and Jennifer Weiner. We recorded this conversation when we took Radio Times on the road to Bryn Mawr College on Tuesday night.
Jen, Who Do You Love is your new book.
Uh-huh.
Which seems like drawn a little bit from your own life.
Yeah.
Can we say that? It's about a woman, Rachel,
uh-huh.
with a broken heart.
With a broken heart.
She's got a congenital heart defect.
Heart defect, yep. And she meets a boy. She's in the hospital having her big stent surgery. He's in the hospital because he's broken his arm. And they meet, and she tells him a story. And they, you know, they go their separate ways. He's from Philadelphia. She lives in Florida. And then 10 years later, they're in high school, and they're both doing this kind of Habitat for Humanity project. And then they meet again and fall in love in this very intense teenager, Romeo and Juliet, wrong side of the tracks kind of way. And we see them through college, and we see them in their 20s, and they break up, and they get back together, and they break up, and they get back together, and it's sort of, are these two people who are clearly meant for each other,
right.
are they ever going to overcome the obstacles, and are they ever going to get it right?
And a little bit about your life now?
I met a guy when I was right out of college. It was my very first job at a newspaper, and he actually came to he came to interview for a job, and he had to spend the day with the editors and the managing editors, and he had to write a story, and then at night one of the reporters got to take him out to dinner. And this was a very coveted assignment because you got like $50 for dinner. Which, you know, when you're making $16,000 a year, that's a really big deal. So I got to take him out to dinner. And we just talked and talked and talked and talked and talked. And I went to the newsroom the next day, and I went to the editor. I'm like, you've got to hire this guy. And he's like, do you think he's really good? I'm like, I have no idea. But I am lonely, and I like him. And so we, you know, they hired him, and we, you know, he had a girlfriend, had to get rid of her. She was Canadian, so, you know, I didn't feel bad. And we dated, and then we broke up. And then we dated again in our late 20s, and then we broke up, and then I married my husband, and we had two beautiful daughters, and then the marriage ended, and it's like 2010, and my dog dies.
Oh.
And Bill had known Wendell, my little rat terrier.
Wendell, sure.
And so I didn't want to look him up on Facebook because I felt that was cliche. So I found his old AOL email address, and I wrote to him, and it was like a one-sentence email, and it said, is this still you? And I'm like, there's no way. Like, who's on AOL anymore, right? But like 5 minutes later, he writes back, and he's like, it's still me. What's going on? And it was, I mean, he said when we met again, he's like, I feel like you just, you know, went away for a long weekend or something. And I'm like, yeah, a long weekend where I like married some other guy and had two kids and wrote 10 books and, you know, that weekend. But, you know, we've been together now since.
That's terrific.
Yeah. No, it is really good, except he won't propose. Like, I got nothing. Nothing.
Well, this
nothing.
Will be on the radio, so
nothing.
This will put some pressure on him.
Nothing. Empty. Watch this space. Right? Like,
and
what
Lisa,
am I
were,
to do?
And Lisa, what? You don't have a boyfriend.
But
and Lisa, you don't...
That was harsh.
I know. I was... I in my last book, I have a sex scene that I wrote from memory. It's great. Thank you. You don't really forget. He does this, then you do that, then he does that, then you do that.
It's like riding a bike.
I know. This is my thing. I actually have an engagement ring. How weird is this?
Can I have it?
I bought it for myself.
Can
yes.
I have it? Can I have it?
I was reminding myself to stay engaged with life.
Really?
I know. And I kind of like
wow.
it. So.
Wow.
You know, all the single ladies.
Well, let me ask you, Lisa, about your book. It's you have two this year, one called Corrupted.
Yes.
Which is drawn in part on the Luzerne scandal involving
right.
the juvenile justice system. We did a number of shows on that.
I know you did.
Absolutely
listen.
Dickensian story about
right.
young people getting in trouble, being hauled before a judge with no lawyer, and then hauled off to these detention facilities, some of them spending years there.
Yeah, they're hauled off to, as you may know in this audience, I don't think nationally it's known, which is part of the reason I wrote about it. The long story was, if you got into a fight in the cafeteria 13 years ago in Luzerne County, Pennsylvania, you were adjudicated delinquent, and you were taken from your family, taken from school, and sent to a prison, which, by the way, the prison was new, which the whole community thought was terrific, except for the fact that the owner and the builder were in cahoots with two common
judges.
Pleas court judges to fill the prison. Those judges were now in federal prison themselves. But the question I really wanted to ask is, first, it is a love story, too. A woman who kind of... Because for me, you're always... The reason the backstory matters in Jen's book, as it does in mine, is because I always think of Francis Ford Coppola. Nothing, he said, nothing in my movies ever happened, but all of it is true.
Mm.
Right?
Mm.
Greg, everyone... You're trying to write something that's emotionally true. So sometimes I lie awake at night and I go, well, gee, what did I do in my life? What would I do differently? What did I do right? What did I do wrong? That's what I gave to Benny, because she lost this case a long time ago.
This is a lawyer.
Exactly. Yeah. Unbeknownst to her, she lost it because the fix was in. And so it's really the story of a woman looking over her own life. And you always want to try to have these issues of law and justice. And what is justice 13 years later, when maybe these kids, thanks to the Juvenile Law Center in Philadelphia, true lawyer heroes... Where, how do you give those kids back their lives? The answer is you don't. And that's really what, you know, what really does justice mean? Beyond the kind of veneer, people say they want justice, but justice is just a consolation prize. What they really want is everything back the way it was.
Yeah. But you also have another book, Every 15 Minutes, about a psychiatrist and a Sociopath.
Right. I did it briefly because I think I dated a sociopath. There we go.
I was wondering about that.
There we go. And I thought, would you know a sociopath if you met one? And then I read something that said 1 in 24 people's a sociopath. Nobody here. Nobody here. And certainly not the major donors. But but then I was like, I interviewed a psychiatrist at Bryn Mawr Hospital, and I said, would you know if you had a if you had a sociopath working for me, for you, wouldn't you see him coming? And this head of psychiatry said, I wouldn't see him coming because he's already there. And I said, that's the next book, which is basically a guess the sociopath. And I fooled myself, so see if I fool you. That's really...
I'm curious, Sue, when you two are writing, and I'll put this to you, Jen, when you're writing, are you fun to be with? When you're in the middle of a novel, do you kind of keep people away?
I'm a joy. I think I'm myself. I mean, I think that there are people who fetishize writing, where it's like, I must be in a room. The room must be silent. The room must be 64 degrees. There must be a white noise machine in the corner, and there must be plastic bags taped over the windows, and no one may disturb me. Right. And I think there's a word for those writers, and it's men. Sorry, men. When you have kids, you write around them. And I've written behind the wheel of my minivan in the carpool line, and I've written at Little Jim when you get old enough that you get to actually leave the Little Jim and your kids are in there and you're watching through the big glass window and you wave when they run by and then you type and you wave and you type. I treat it like a job, and I was a newspaper reporter.
I was wondering about that.
Yeah, so it's like, okay, I have a deadline, I have work to do, I know how many words I need to write, and I don't get all, like, foofy about, like, oh, the muse has not spoken to me. Because it's like, you know, if you write for newspapers and the muse hasn't spoken, you're unemployed. You know, it's like, no one is going to wait for the muse to come and inspire you to write that 12-incher about the sewage board hearing. Like, you just write it. And so I try to be professional. It's always my goal to be the least crazy person that my agent or my editor or my publisher has to deal with. It's not hard.
And for you, Lisa, you are really disciplined in that when you start the day, your goal is to write 2,000 words.
Right.
And you're not done until you write those 2,000 words.
Right. I mean, my life is different now that my daughter is 29 and, you know, and she stopped nursing, which was... really the bummer. I always say that, you know, they said the difference between Italian mother and a Rottweiler, and it's really that the Rottweiler eventually lets go. Like, so I sort of live alone in this house, and I have the time to write, which I kind of love. So I sort of, I think Jen is absolutely right. I'd like the approach that's like, get over yourself a little.
Right.
Because what I think's good about that is I love people. And, like, we were in the ladies' room having a great time because women and men tell each other stories. And so you're just sitting down and telling a story. In my case, you're telling it to yourself. You have 2,000 words, which is good because sometimes I can finish by 6, but most times it takes me till 10 o'clock at night. And the good thing about the 2,000-word limit is just it's a way to say that's what you're aiming for. And also, by the way, that's when you're done, because I think, look at this earnest group. Mm. You know, plenty of us work way too hard, and especially if you work at your home, then you're like, well, I could either, you know, watch the game, or I can, look how manly I said, you can either watch something on TV or you can work. But if you've done 2,000 words, you're done. You'll make all your marks. I'm doing 2 novels a year and a nonfiction collection. And that's the clip. And I have a treadmill desk, which is my new toy, and it's totally fun.
Oh, wow.
I know.
So you're getting exercise while you write. Wow.
I know. I go really... Luckily, I'm a really stinky typist. And I type really slow, and I walk really slow, and at least it's healthier, I think.
I've interviewed writers who said, you know, I love to write, and then there are other writers who say, I love to have written. You know, I love to, when it's all over, to sort of feel like,
I'm done.
I'm a writer. I'm done. Do you feel that way, Jen, sometimes?
I love writing. I really do. I feel so lucky. I mean, like I said, this is the only thing I ever wanted to do with my life. It's the only thing I wanted to be when I grew up. And I feel lucky and privileged every day. And I love writing. I mean, I think maybe it comes from being like sort of an awkward, unhappy kid, is to sort of slip into another reality. And it's a reality that you can control. And, you know, all the endings can be happy if you want them that way. So I love writing. Yeah. I love writing. I mean, and as any mother of young children will tell you, your job is the easiest part of your day. You know, like being a mom, like to me, that's the really hard, wearing stuff, you know, where I stay up at night and worry about failing.
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure. Well, and Lisa, you get to write with your daughter.
I do.
And I think for so many parents, that is a fantasy. I mean, a dream come true to do something with a child.
I know. I feel so lucky. And the truth is, to be fair, we don't do it together per se. So, for example, I'll write some essays and she'll write some essays. We put them together at the end. We're always surprised at what we wrote about. There was the time I'll never forget when she wrote an essay about how she reads the wedding announcements in the New York Times. I'm 29, so I'm counting down from everyone else married at 32. I should be married. And I wrote an essay about how I read the obituaries and I'm counting down. I still have a couple more years yet. Like, we realized we're both completely like crazy with the counting, except with different, you know, ends in mind.
And it's called chick lit, which is, you know, some people struggle with that whole chick thing. I mean, certainly the chick lit part has been an issue, Jen. I don't know if we're over that by now.
I don't see it much anymore. It was incredibly galling when it first came out because there was Bridget Jones' Diary, and then there was sort of this spate of books by young women about young women trying to sort of make their way in the world, and they weren't seen as crap. I sort of feel like what happened was it turned into a trend. It sort of hit critical mass, and then of course the critics, as is frequently the case with things that are popular and give women pleasure, critics have to find a way to dismiss them. And so chick lit was born, you know. And I'm just like, you know, fantastic. You know, I studied English literature at Princeton. I was a journalist for 10 years, and now my first novel is being compared to crappy Square Gum. You know, it was just like, God, really? You know, really? Because I would read books by men and be like, but that's what I'm doing. Only, you know, their books get very different covers. Their books get very different receptions. Their books get very different treatment. Their books get very fewer readers than mine do, which is the trade-off. But, you know, it's like, I mean, I really do wonder, because somebody asked once, like, if you could have respect instead of sales and money, would you pick it? And I'm like, I don't know. I don't know, because I have to imagine like that somewhere there's a writer who is incredibly well respected and has won many prizes and sells like 5,000 copies of every book. That's like, I want that, you know. I want to have written, you know, the Sunday Women's Knitting Diary Club and you know have sold 100,000 copies or whatever.
But I think you have both, don't you? I respect you.
Well, I appreciate that.
And I think I have both. I mean, I sometimes think, especially in mystery thriller, my aunt, I always think of Nancy Drew. So they can say what they want about chick lit, but I love Nancy Drew. And I love the power that we have in our women characters, and you have that in spades. And so I think there is a great tradition there. And sometimes it's true, it gets a little warped. I always think of this weird story, which will make you laugh, but I was, when you're on tour, you can see people picking up your book. And so I happened to be in the Atlanta airport, and I saw a guy pick up my book. And I was like, oh my God, is he going to buy it? I want to see. And he looked at the back. The back is a completely fictional author photo of me. I look like a virgin. It's great. And thank you, Photoshop. And so then he looks all over. He reads the first chapter. He puts it back. I'm like, no. So what I did, I actually went and bought the book and brought it to him.
Wow.
And I said, sir, I'm the author, though I look nothing like this child in the back. I'd love for you to have a copy of my book, but I'm wondering why you didn't buy it. And he said, well, I don't buy books by women. I said, okay, it's all right. I asked.
He's not alone, apparently.
That's all right. He certainly isn't. And people are entitled. So I said, you know what? You still haven't. Will you take the book, and I'll sign it for you, and let me know what you think. He wrote me 3 days later. He said, I really loved your book. You write like a man.
Oh, jeez.
That's okay. I'll take it. Right. I'll take it. I'll take it. You just do it one at a time. You just do one at a time. And you go
Jen
forward.
Jen is just rolling her eyes there.
Well,
I press on regardless.
It's so hard because I know the way my books are packaged and the way they're sold. Men think they're going to get their periods if they read them. I know that. But I also know that women read far more fiction than men. So, okay, does it make sense to sort of cater to the male gaze the way everything else does? You know, to get these theoretical male readers and perhaps alienate women who are the meat and potatoes. I mean, they're the ones that are out there buying most fiction. It's Harry Potter. It's not Hermione Granger's story. And she was J.K., not Joanne. And I'm like, here we are.
I think the truest thing, this is just me. By the way, my readers are about equal parts men. I will get letters that they'll find different parts in the book that speak to them. And the real truth about the novel is that it doesn't speak to your reproductive organs at all. You know, it's really about a sensibility, and that sensibility, I really believe, isn't attached to a gender. And that's why books connect people. That's why the arts connect people.
You have written a number of books with these recurring characters.
Yes.
Do they surprise you?
They always surprise me.
Even though you must know them so well.
Well, I don't. I mean, and the truth is, the way that, you know, your best friend surprises you, or you surprise yourself. You know, I recently lost my mother. I didn't know what I would look like or how I would act or what would happen. And what you're always doing, anybody, right? You're writing a story where there's an event, like your event's very clear, they're in the hospital. How will this life-changing event affect the person? That is the story of your life, isn't it? And if you're friends with somebody for 10 years, you've watched them go through changes, whether it's marriages or sadly losing somebody or falling in love again or getting yet another dog. All that stuff.
Right.
That was Lisa Scottolini and Jennifer Weiner, recorded earlier this week when we took Radio Times on the road to Bryn Mawr College. They are both best-selling novelists with a devoted fan base. Lisa's latest book is Corrupted. She also writes a column with her daughter in the Philadelphia Inquirer called Chick Wit. Jennifer's latest book is Who Do You Love? And she's an op-ed contributor to the New York Times. We're going to take a very short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. Stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. You're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY. Let's get back to our interview with novelist Jennifer Weiner and Lisa Scottolini, recorded on Tuesday night when we took Radio Times on the road to Bryn Mawr College, talking about how they write, reviews, sexism, and coming up, the Kardashians, chin hair, and their daughters.
Jen, let me ask you about something you wrote in the New York Times. It's an op-ed, actually, about the pressure to look good in public.
Oh.
And you wrote, every day is class picture day.
Yeah.
The idea that everyone's got a cell phone.
Yep.
So if you're in your scrunchies and your whatever flip-flops and whatever, someone's going to take your picture.
Yeah, you're screwed. You know, it's, again, social media. I mean, I remember when I was just starting out, you know, people would buy the book and they'd want the book signed. And that would be sort of the artifact that they took away from the event. Now everybody wants a picture. Everybody wants a picture. And I feel like everything's photographed these days. And I feel like there's this generation of millennials where it almost didn't happen unless it's on Instagram. And I think that that is going to have really interesting impacts on the way women feel about themselves, the way women present themselves, maybe men too, but I think this stuff always...
Well, but isn't the answer... We have the answer. Don't worry about it.
Yeah.
Hmm. Like, I mean, and it's like what we learned in sixth grade. Like, in sixth grade, I was all over it, right? And now when my daughter was in sixth grade, I'm embarrassed to quote Dr. Phil.
No, but no.
He always... Can I?
You do it once.
I watch. What
no more than once.
But he says, you know, something like, you wouldn't worry so much about how people are looking at you if you knew how rarely they are.
Right.
Yeah. And that's what I want to say. And it's all the same thing of everything. Don't worry about it. I mean,
except
the answer. We have that power. We can give it up or we can keep it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't care if they take my picture.
You have a quizzical look on your face, Jen.
I worry because I see, you know, people getting tagged, people tagging other people, people untagging themselves, or you know, girls taking, you know, 30 selfies just to get the right one. And, like, how much time is that taking?
That's true.
You know, and I worry about the Kardashians. Like, I worry that we... I swear to God...
You and the rest of America.
I was at Book Expo, and Khloe Kardashian, who I gather has emitted a book... was in the room next to me. I think it's called, like, Look Strong Naked or Strong is the New Sexy or Sexy Strong Naked or something. And I have never seen an entourage that big. And I've been, like, backstage at rock shows. I mean, 30 people. And, like, I think half of them were hair and makeup. I'd love to think, and I for sure tell my daughters, like, this doesn't matter. This really does not matter. Like, at the end of the day, nobody is lying on their deathbed thinking, if only I'd found a different filter for that one selfie that time. Like, no one does that.
But on the other hand, let me just, because you write in the Philadelphia Inquirer, Lisa.
Right.
And you wrote recently about your dandruff. You wrote about your skin problems, something with your forehead.
I like
it. You seem to put things out there about just, this is my life.
Well, I think Jen is making a good point. It's not a contrary to her point, but I think a little bit it goes back to, if you're going to tell something emotionally true in a novel or in nonfiction essays, you're going to tell something literally true. So you're going to write about, you know, the day you see a gray chin hair and you realize you're turning into an Amish man. Like, like I plucked for tonight. You know, did you pluck for me? Because I plucked for you. And somebody needs to say that. And I think what happens is, as Jen will tell you, the more you get used to saying it, because luckily, I mean, look, I worry about what I look like. In fact, I tweeted tonight. I couldn't find my contacts. And then I said, what do I care? Like, look, people wear glasses in the world. And so the great thing about being, that I've said to myself, is I don't make a living on how I look.
Yes.
You have daughters,
yeah. Mm-hmm.
You have three daughters between the two of you. Yeah. How have you raised your daughters different from the way that you were raised, Jen?
I'm the oldest of four, and I mean, my mom put us in playpens when we were toddlers and left us there and smoked Virginia Slims and drank white wine spritzers. And then when we were older, you know, you went out and played. Like, you just, like, come home for dinner. And, like, mom kind of knew where you were, you know, but, like, we could ride our bikes. We could go sledding. We could go swimming. Like, there wasn't this, like, you know, like, hover, because there's child molesters and, you know, I need to know exactly where you are at every moment of the day. And I've, like, GPSed your phone and I can, like, track you. Like, I feel like I was a very free-ranging kid and had to take care of myself a lot. And, you know, I think
you
I was...
You try to impart that to your daughters?
Well, I do, but it's hard. It's like the bus stop's half a block from my house. I'd love to let my 8-year-old just walk there by herself, but none of the other parents let their kids walk, and I don't want them to judge me. So it's like I'm in this really difficult place where I want my girls to be independent. I want them to be resilient. I want them to know what it's like to screw up and have to fix something or to be in a difficult situation and have to get out of it. And I feel like that was a gift that my childhood gave me. And I think so much about how am I going to give them this gift in an era where parenting's changed so much.
How about for you, Lisa? And we sort of feel like we knew your mom, Mother Mary.
Yeah.
How were you raised?
I think, what do I do differently? You know, the weird thing is I think it's very similar, which is probably, I mean, my mother loved us with a ferocity that, you know, we did go outside and play a little, but we otherwise never left the kitchen. And nobody was complaining. Like, there's snacks, and there's always a meatball sandwich, and it was great. But I always say, and she hated when I said this, but there was one book in the house. And people always say, oh, was the book the Bible? And I say, no, the book was TV Guide. Like,
So the Bible.
Exactly.
So the Bible.
Another Bible,
you know?
Yeah.
And I think, in a way, I probably, if there's one thing I've done more recently with my daughter is to say, take more risk. Like, and that's what I do more myself. Like, don't sweat it. Like you say, you fail. I mean, I was unpublished for a long time. My first novel was never published. She saw a lot of struggle. We were broke, like, a long time. She was, you know, so she saw that, and I think that's a good thing. She just finished her first novel and sent it out to agents and got some rejections and got an acceptance from a wonderful agent. And that's the message, I think, for everybody. Isn't it kind of like, just live, give it a shot, throw it on the wall. You know, nobody's really looking, and who cares? Look,
I like that.
That doesn't sound very responsible.
Well,
but
no, I think it sounds terrific.
Try.
We have a microphone here, so if you have any questions for our guests, Lisa and Jen. Yes, go ahead, sir.
I find it interesting that you two seem to feel that readers are looking past the book to see you as people. I don't, as a reader. I mean, if I read, say, a Grisham book, I can't even tell you whether Grisham is married or what. I know he sort of likes sports from what he's written. And but I have no intention of looking behind it. I'm more interested in getting the enjoyment and the satisfaction of reading the book. And it doesn't make any difference. I mean, remember, Frankenstein was written by a woman, so it doesn't make any difference. And that's not typical of your later books, I should say. But it, why do you seem to feel that the reader is really looking past the book to you as people?
That's an interesting question. Jen, you want to take that first?
I think it's generational. And I think that there are people who have gotten the idea that they deserve to know everything about an author, and they can find it, they can Google you, they can connect with you on Facebook, they can hook up with you on Twitter, they can follow you on Instagram, and you can follow them. When I published my first book, there was like a one-paragraph biography and a tiny little stamp-sized author photo. That was it. That was all anybody got. And then it's like, no, you need a website. And your website has to have pictures, and your website has to have an expanded biography with hyperlinks to other things you've written. And if you've been on TV, you got to put that appearance on your website. And then along came MySpace, and we were all told to be on MySpace. And then along came Facebook, and we were all told to be on Facebook. I think that publishers believe, correctly or not, that allowing readers to connect with writers more intimately and more personally is going to create more loyalty. Like, once a reader feels like you know John Grisham or you know Stephen King, you can read his blog, you can read his tweets, you're going to be more likely to buy his book, and you're also going to know about it more, because when Stephen King has a new book out, he tweets it, and it's on his website. So I think that's what happened, and I do believe that there are readers who are very happy just to have the book, just to have that pure experience. But for better or worse, I think the rising generation has gotten used to access in a way that we never have had access before.
I mean, Lisa, do you feel like you have a relationship with your readers?
I do, but I think it's all choice. This is America. How great is it? It's all choice. So you choose not to. That's wonderful. I think there's some people who choose to. I don't feel so cognizant of it, maybe as you do. But I do think I'm glad people can choose if they want. I love to read, and I read really widely. So it's always sort of interesting to me to read a book. Like, for example, this is random, but there's an author named John Connolly. He is actually Irish, but he writes about a New York cop. Hmm. Now, I started to read this book about, and I said, you know, I'm a really critical reader, and I'm loving this. This sounds so real to me. I wonder if this guy was a cop. I went to the back, and I admit I look at the guy pictures. Like, I'd look. And there's this author photo, and it says he's Irish. And I'm like, and that disconnect, it happened with The Remains of the Day, too, a different kind of book.
Did you Google him, though?
No, because I don't care enough. I only follow people who I like Jen, I follow her. I buy tons of books and I don't really look, but I love the disconnect when someone channeled so perfectly, because it's all about voice. Mm. And it's all about the authenticity of the voice. So when, no matter what the rapper is or whatever the genre is or whoever gives you grief, you know? And so I love that somebody channeled so beautifully a New York City cop, and he's just a guy who lives in Ireland and isn't a policeman at all.
Yes, another question back here.
Who reads your books after you write them? Who's the first reader?
Who's your very first reader? You finished a manuscript.
No
one.
My editor and my agent read them at the same time. Nobody reads me before that, and I don't discuss it with anybody before that. It's a little incubator. I have an assistant who's my best friend. She will all bounce ideas off of her, but I don't show it to anybody.
Is it just because it's yours?
I want to preserve my vision. Maybe I'm listening to Jen now. I'm going, I probably have blinders on. It's the Scottolini denial. Yeah. You know, I probably screen myself away from a lot of stuff, and it's protective. As a quick aside, sometimes I think of it when I'm writing as, I think of it as protecting the candle. You know, when you're protecting your work, you've got to put a little handle like they do in the old-time movies. So you're going to protect yourself, too, and your emotionality. That's why I'm not a big fan of writer's groups sometimes, because you show your work to something, this sucks, and then you never do it. And so I'm not interested in that. I want to show it to a professional whose economic interest in, and editing is not easy, so they have to help you figure out to say what you want to say better. And I don't want anybody else to look at it before then anyway.
I always think it's such an interesting relationship between the writer and the editor.
It's great.
Yeah, it is
great. I have a wonderful editor. I love my editor.
It's great. We have another question way in the back there. Yes.
Hi. Since we started off talking about getting more exposure for female writers, I was wondering if you had any book recommendations, like other great books by female writers that
we
should read?
Oh, gosh. Jen just raised her hand.
Yes. Okay. I just read The Turner House by Angela Florney. It was nominated for the National Book Award. It didn't win. It's fantastic. It's about a family of 13 children. It's set in Detroit. It's about addiction, poverty, race, urban, you know, what's going on in cities. As a Philadelphian, I found a lot to relate to. I loved Fates and Furies by Lauren Groff. I loved A Little Life by Hanya Yanagihara. Gosh, in Dietland. There's this book called Dietland by Saray Walker, which is one of the most radical things I think I've ever read. There's a picture of a cupcake on the front cover, but it's not a cupcake, it's a grenade. And it's about a woman who becomes a very heavy woman who wants weight loss surgery because then her life will start. And she becomes radicalized by this group, this underground group of feminists called Jennifer. And it's
excellent,
awesome. Awesome. So The Turner House, A Little Life, Fates and Furies, Dietland. Those are the books I'm pimping.
For a good one.
Yes.
Do you have a recommendation, Lisa?
Quickly, I love The Nightingale by Kristen Hanna. I also like books by men. David Baldacci wrote Memory Man, which was wonderful. Gary Steingart, I'm a little behind, wrote a book called Little Failure, which is a wonderful memoir.
Terrific.
So funny and brilliant. I read Louise Penny. She's, if you like mystery, wonderful mystery series set in Canada. Oh, there's just so many great books.
Great. Thank you for the question. Can you imagine not writing?
You want me to say no. Do you want to know the truth?
I do want to know
the truth. Yeah, I can. Sure. I love what I do, but it nothing doesn't really define me. And I'm very capable of being lazy, and I love to hang with my dogs, and I love to hang with my kid, and I talk on the phone. You know, I can go into a very nice beta wave. Yeah, sure.
I enjoy it. How about for you, Jen?
I don't think so. My friend Sharon and I always joke about, like, oh, if I'm just gonna win the lottery and I'm gonna buy an island, and she's like, you'd be like lying in the sun for 2 hours, and then you'd go find a notebook and a pen. So I love it. I love it, and I can't imagine not writing something somehow, somewhere. You know, and again, I think it goes back to journalism. It goes back to, like, being at a small newspaper and writing 3 stories a day plus typing in the school lunches for 5 school districts. Like, it just, you know, a day when I don't write feels like a day where I didn't get anything done.
The time I feel weird is when I don't read. I like to read every day. And would love to read guilt-free. You know, sometimes I put someone else's book down and go, okay, you need to get to work.
Right.
Oh,
yeah.
Yes. Excellent. Excellent. Well, it's been really fun. My thanks to Lisa Scottolini, Jennifer Weiner.
Thank you.
To all of you as well.
Thank you
very much.
Thank you.
That was novelist Jennifer Weiner and Lisa Scottolini, recorded at Bryn Mawr College when we took Radio Times on the road, recorded before an audience of WHYY donors and supporters. Send us an email with your reactions and feedback, whyy.org/radiotimes. Also, thanks to Bryn Mawr College for their hospitality and their use of their beautiful hall. And thanks to WHYY's Brittany Smith, our liaison for these special events. Charlie Kyer was our engineer. John Ahrens produced and edited the show. Radio Times producers are Susan Greenbaum, Debbie Builder, Emily Bryant, and Liz Fiedler. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.